Every time our athletes walk into this weight room, they're going to be pushed to the max.
Let's go!
The barbell hasn't changed in over 100 years. I can take a 25-pound plate, and we'll go out on the turf, and I'll have you hating life. We talk about straining your gut, pushing past that comfort level. I want a lot of energy.
What better breeding ground is there for being a success in life than the weight room?
Hey guys, welcome back to Iron Game Chalk Talk. I'm your host, Rob McKee, for this episode number 297. I want to thank you guys for listening each week. Really appreciate those of you that like, share, comment. Just helps us continue to highlight the great people we have in the profession. I want to thank our sponsors, or our sponsor for this year, Train Heroic. You know, as I've said many, many times, they're a phenomenal group of people, first and foremost. They have an excellent product. So if you're looking for a delivery system for your training programs, reach out to them. If you're an entrepreneur and you're trying to find some ways to create some additional revenue streams, their marketplace is fantastic as well to be able to put some of the programs up. But like I said many, many times, I only partner with people that I believe in, both the product and the people, they're fantastic. So check them out. This week I'm joined by Keir Wyndham Flatt. He is known as the rugby strength coach, but one of the early questions was, is he going to change his name of his website to football now that he's working American football? But appreciate you coming on, man.
Mate, it's good to be here. You know, like I've followed your stuff for, it must be close to a decade. I'm a bit of a lurker, like never really spoken, but I've followed you for a long time.
Yeah, no, it's likewise, and I've just been super impressed with what you've done, and appreciate all the time, and it's unfortunate that we haven't had a chance to get to know each other in person yet, but we'll make sure to remedy that in the future here, right? Yeah, a little bit of lag time. You still there, bub?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Good. Yeah, we lost you there for a second, but I was just saying that we're going to make sure that we catch up sometime down the road here.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, man, you know, I always jump in. You know, you've been in professional rugby for quite some time. You're now, working in William and Mary. Which experience in your journey best defines you, or which one's had the most impact on you as a coach?
Early and profound failure. I tell people, like, when I started in this field, I came out of university in 2008, perfect timing with a recession, so no job market, and I had two interviews for internships with professional sports clubs straight off the bat and didn't get either of them, and it was readily apparent in those interviews that I'd spent 3 years basically learning to become a researcher and not a coach. And it was like a slap to the face, like, all right, I need to learn how to coach. And I would define coaching as basically getting an athlete to do what is in your head. So right. the academics is the foundation, but there is an art and a science to coaching. And the art was completely absent from my graduate education. And you know, you look at me, like I'm not clearly a natural athlete. So I was just an enthusiastic trainer that had to learn how to be a coach, no real insider connections. And, you know, it took me over 2 years just to get to the point where I could work for free for a professional rugby club.
Right.
And you know, I've had a lot of failure since then. And I think that has been valuable, because if it had been handed to me or I just landed on my feet, maybe I wouldn't have been forced to learn those lessons. And, you know, I'd say combining that with just being extremely stubborn and analytical has kind of got me this far.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's such a common thing. I mean, be it, you know, that you're just such a charismatic, you know, eccentric coach that you didn't maybe get the science background, or vice versa. You spent all this time in almost a laboratory type of setting. You get into it, and all of a sudden you figure out really quick that it's a combination of the two. And if you don't have both, you're not gonna make it very long. And the only way to do that sometimes is to get those unpaid positions or those internship type positions and really, figure out what your strengths and your weaknesses are.
Well, you see the same in staffing as well. Like, what applies to the individual applies to staffing as well, because, you know, I can certainly tell you from professional rugby that there are, not to like have a clear dividing line down the middle, but, you know, I call them like bookworm coaches that are very numbers, detailed, scientific. Then you have the lunatic coaches on the other side. And I think if you are heading up a department or a club, you have to have enough insight into yourself to pick somebody that balances out quite well with you. Because if you have two bookworms or, you know, three bookworms, you only pick coaches in your mold, you're going to have a group that just has a fantastic program on paper, but when you've just got beaten 50-0 at the weekend, you have to come in on Monday morning. Right. They don't want to be with they want to be with the Scott Cochrane type. But, you know, having the live wires without the detail to back it up, you know, it's kind of like, you know, lunatics running the asylum. It's you want that balance there in the staff, for sure.
Yeah, I think it's so important. I talk a lot about, you know, there's a personality test by Gary Smiley that's, you know, you're basically you're a lion, an otter, a beaver, a retriever, and everybody has strengths and weaknesses. And so that lion is, you know, they're very out in front. They pound their chest. They're vision casters. They're the leaders that you follow up the hill. But when it comes to the details, they're not nearly as detailed as that beaver, maybe, you know.
And so I can't relate.
You have to have both. My dogs are going to go crazy here. But you have to have both. We grab the mic. Thanks. You have to have both. And if you put two lions in a cage, they're going to fight, right? And so mm-hmm. you got to balance it out. So I couldn't agree with you more there. You know, I always, I like to ask coaches their biggest mistake and how they learn from it, because I think it helps us avoid some of the landmines that, you know, as you're going down a journey, if you can avoid some of those landmines, you're going to get to where they're at, hopefully faster. Right. So what, you know, in your history, I know there's lots of mistakes. We all make them, but what's one of the biggest that you've made and how you've learned from it?
Man, I'm just trying to narrow it down to one. It was done very early in my career. I would say because I was an academic, because I found the intellectual side of it easy, I had the idea that how I was going to get a job was just on the merits of my work. Now, it's true, you do have to have an intellectual side to the job, but you know, a vivid memory that sticks out in my mind was I was basically pushed to an interview and told, if you don't mess this up, the job is yours. So I went there, did this massive long interview, and it turns out they gave it to a guy that was best man at the head coach's wedding.
Yep.
And the feedback on the interview was, oh, we thought you were technically better in the interview. And at which point I switched off because they gave me three reasons that didn't matter. But
right.
They actually offered me an assistant position. Oh, we're going to develop you and stuff like that. So I go into the job, and within a few weeks, it's like obvious to me that I've not got that job because I don't lack that connection.
Yeah.
So I promise myself, you know, I'm never going to be that guy again with the qualifications and the knowledge, or necessarily without the connections. And I've kind of expanded it since then. It's not just networking for the sake of getting a job, but it's true that if you do want to get jobs, you're going to have to have people that know, like, and trust you, and you're going to have to persuade them as to your value to their program. And he did a better job than me on that day. And it's the same in training. Like, if you want athletes to do what's in your head, ultimately it all hinges on persuasion. You can't force them to do it. It's not North Korea. You have to persuade them and ask them to do what's in your head. And the quality of your persuasion is going to dictate how well they adhere to the program, how well you can get a head coach to play ball with you and not try and torpedo your program, how well you can get people to coordinate together. And I think once you graduate to a certain level as a high performance manager, it's basically just trying to get people to march to the beat of the same drum. And that's persuasion.
That's exactly right. Super smart too. I mean, I talk a lot about know, like, and trust. And I mean, that's who you work for. That's who you buy from. It's the whole deal. You know, networking has this kind of negative connotation almost, I think, in our field, where we think it's bad to have an extensive network or build a database of friends in the community. But I mean, it's such a tight knit tough community. And when you have been that high performance manager, you have been that leader, the challenge becomes, you know, you, especially when you're in professional sport, like you, if you don't absolutely trust that person with every ounce of what you got, if you don't absolutely trust mm-hmm. that person, I mean, if they make a mistake, I mean, it could cost everybody, you know? So there's got to be that trust there in a big, big way. And so I agree. What are some of the things that you found? I mean, I know you started strengthcoachnetwork.com as a way of potentially maybe networking a bit. What are some other ways that you found a network?
I mean, it's kind of like, I think it's like when you buy, not going to buy a product that you doesn't know exists. That you don't know exist. So, you know, you have to know it exists first before you buy it. And then what he does when they get on Amazon is they go to the customer reviews and say, right, what do people say about this? So when it comes to networking, the first thing is people have to know you exist. And then I think you have to put valuable contributions to the field out there that people are going to say good things about. So, you know, when I think about when I went to Australia, I was keenly aware that I was going there and nobody knew who I was and nobody knew anything about my work. But I had a couple of lectures that I did for my previous college on DVD, back in the days of DVD. So I ripped it, uploaded it to YouTube and sent it to every club just saying, here it is. I hope you get value from it. Not asking for a job or anything. But then I knew when I arrived 6 months later, they knew who I was to say yes to me visiting, arranging a meeting, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, doing in the States here, when I presented at track football, again, I was aware, it, you know, I may have a small profile in rugby, but nobody in American football knows who I am whatsoever. So I said to the organizer of track football, if you pay for the hotel and the flight, I'll present for free. And I did.
Right.
Central Virginia, I had the presentation that I did in rehab, immediately went out to four different NFL clubs and I said, here you go, I hope you like it.
Right.
Not asking for anything, but it's just trying to firstly make people aware that I exist, I think is a fairly important part to getting a job. Because if they don't know you exist, it doesn't matter how good you are.
Exactly right. Exactly right. I think there's a book by Gary Vaynerchuk that's jab, 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 right hook, you know, and
yeah, I read it.
You know, and it's such a, you know, I think a lot of strength coaches haven't. I think that's sometimes a mistake where we stay so focused on our own discipline that we don't look to other disciplines for inspiration. But that entrepreneurial mm-hmm. space, that business space, that, you know, law and different disciplines, you can pull from those and apply them to strength and conditioning. And I think that's a great takeaway, common in the entrepreneurial world, where you're giving content, you're giving resources without mm-hmm. with a genuine intent that you don't necessarily want something in return, but then when you do go to make an ask because you've provided such value over time, people open their doors to you, you know. And I think the motivation has to be pure, you know, but it definitely has a professional benefit down the road if you do it over time. So I couldn't agree Absolutely. More. You talked a little bit about, you know, making the switch from rugby to football, you know, and everybody that is probably even watching this knows you as a rugby strength coach. It's like, you're like, oh, that's Kier. I was like, dude, I didn't even recognize your name based off of that. You know? But I totally knew who you were. I think you making that decision to go from professional rugby to football, obviously there was some, you know, some reasons there. What caused you to make that switch and why come to the US and kind of take that on when you're so accomplished in that rugby world?
A variety of different reasons. I think, you know, I think I maybe said it publicly, like when I was an intern, I was turning 25 when I became an intern. And I said that my dream was to be a head strength and conditioning coach in the Premiership by the time I was 30. And I did it at 28 and I was like, oh, what do I do now? And then it was, you know, it didn't really work out at that club. But then I went back to Argentina and we went to the World Cup, went great. And for a variety of reasons, I was like, well, I'm probably not going to go to a World Cup again. And we're probably not going to do as well. And I don't want to keep chasing what I can't really control. So I went to Japan, cashed out for a couple of years there, and it got to the point where I felt like intellectually it was getting to the point where I'm doing it's, if you go to a club and you do a good job for 3 years, like, you can have a profound impact and that's extremely rewarding, but intellectually you're doing the same thing again and again. It's yes. Like, let's start these habits off, let's make these changes, blah 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 blah, which is, it's fun and I was good at it, but then I thought, you know, I'd need a change. And I think, kind of like, you know, New York by Frank Sinatra, you know, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. If you can make it in the NFL, which is, the to me, is the biggest meat market in sports, it's the best athletes in the world, it's the biggest business in the world. If you can make an impact in American sports, that's really, really good. It's a nice challenge for me. And I think, you know, always try and be the dumbest person in the room. I think many of the world's best coaches are in this country, and one of the main reasons I came here is Eric Corum, who's one of the smartest coaches I know, and it's a pleasure to work underneath him.
Sure. Yeah, I think obviously having been in the NFL and major college and mostly football my whole career, I can attest to that. I mean, it's like you said. I mean, you get a system down. You know, it's fun to kind of go and maybe go to a new, an organization that hasn't experienced that level of detail or organization or whatever it may be. But it does get old after a while, you know. And once you got it turned around, it kind of becomes it's not as challenging. And yeah, you know, going through and working with the Chinese Olympic Committee this year and working with rowing, which I never would have ever thought about working with rowing before. But mm-hmm. I mean, it's a freaking sadistic sport now. It's sadistic, you know, 2,000 meters as hard as you possibly can go. I had to go back through that learning process of going through the needs analysis and watching the sport. And it really was a lot of fun. And I think that so many coaches, sometimes you want to become so specialized in one sport, but seeing a bunch of, you know, working with a lot of different types of sports, a lot of different athletes and different cultures, you want to grow and you want to grow fast. That's a quick way to do it.
Absolutely. Especially, you know, like those foreign cultures, and like coaching in a second language will make you a way better coach in your first language. I've learned that. No, and it will teach you to be economical with your words as well.
That's it. Economical. That's great. Yeah. I love that line. You know, I've heard you talk before just about, you know, and this is something I've always, you know, whenever I've talked with David Joyce or Lachlan Wilmot or, you know, guys that are in other sports, I'm like, hey, look, I want you to rip apart American football. I want you to, you know, tell me how you would attack it. You know, I've heard you present and talk about, you know, the combine test. I mean, it's combine time right now. Combine prep time. Everybody's doing it. Talk a little bit about the validity of the test and what maybe you would do it, you know, looking at it from a little bit different lens.
Well, I think, you know, when you are looking to develop an athlete, you are trying to analyze exactly what it is the sport demands from them in terms of the movement patterns, so the biodynamics, the physical qualities that most strongly correlate with that position, which is the biomotor abilities, and then the energy system demands, or the energy system qualities that most underpin that sport or event. So that's the bioenergetics. And, you know, if we look, it can be difficult to analyze in field-based sports because the demands are fairly broad. But I think it's a true statement to say that elite athletes make their living by doing one or two things to an elite level, and then they're good at a bunch of stuff, or they're okay at a bunch of stuff. And I call it the postcard test. If you can write it down on a postcard what it is your position does better than anyone else in the field, that is your SPP. And those are the biodynamics, the biomotor abilities, and the bioenergetic qualities that we need to assess and program in terms of, and hopefully test in terms of. Because to use an extreme example from track and field, if I'm a 100-meter sprinter and my event is 10 seconds of all-out alactic effort, should I judge my ability to be a sprinter based on a 60-second all-out 400-meter sprint? And just thinking about football, if we know that the average duration of a football play in a balanced offense is 5.2 seconds, and they have 36.2 seconds between plays, and they do an average of six plays per drive, because I read the research, how does 24 110s with 30 seconds recovery evaluate an athlete's ability to play the sport of football? And it doesn't. And you look at this in the combine as well. If the longest run that an offensive lineman ever does is running to the sideline, why are we evaluating them in a 40-yard sprint at the combine? If a play duration is 5.2 seconds, why are we giving them a bench press test that takes almost a minute to perform for the heaviest guys? And you can look at stuff like that. I think when we talk about the skillies, the 40 is useful, the broad is useful, the vert is useful. But then I think, you know, the linemen kind of get a hard deal. I think we could have more specific tests for those guys. I think if your job is to move very, very heavy stuff for a few yards in short bursts, I would love to see something like, you know, a body weight prowler push for 5 yards timed, for example. Right. We're actually in the process here at William & Mary, we've devised an intermittent shuttle test for our conditioning test for our guys, which mimics the time motion demands of football. And we're going to try and bring in a lineman-specific version where we start you on the goal line. We have an arbitrary amount of weight on the prowler. On the whistle, you have 5 seconds to push it as far as possible. We blow the whistle and you rest for 25 seconds because we're an up-tempo offense. You repeat for 12 bouts, which hopefully is a goal-line-to-goal-line drive. And right. Then we look at your distance. So that gives us your peak power output, which is how much you cover in one rep. We look at the total capacity of the system, which is how much distance do you cover in those 12 reps. And then we also look at the decrement, so the fatigue index of how much did you cover in rep 1 versus rep 12. And hopefully that's going to be a more specific evaluation of our guys' preparation to play the sport of football than anything like a, you know, half gasses, 110s, 300s, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think most of the people, at least scouts and coaches that I know, they all, you know, I think most of them would agree with that. I think a lot of them are so reluctant to give up the test because it's because there's been such baseline that, you know, created through the years and being able to look back and compare some of the NFL greats, you know, to the current talent pool. They use it as a benchmark comparison, you know, more so than even, you know, finding out who can handle the demands of the sport the best or whatnot. So I think that there's a mixture there that needs to occur to try to keep to appease the traditionalists. But I think, you know, making a wholesale change, I think is going to be something that's going to be tough to do in today's market, especially now that the freaking whole combine's on TV, right?
I love it. Like, it just as a spectacle, I love it.
Absolutely. I agree with you. I've heard you talk also about, you know, the OODA loop concept and agility. Talk a little bit about what that is and what your thoughts are on it.
So if we, you know, a fundamental concept that we talk about here at William & Mary is reverse engineering sports performance. So if we look at the demands of agility, what we have to do is be able to perceive our environment because we use our senses to derive information from the environment and create our model of the world. So we have to observe our environment. Then we have to orientate ourselves within that environment. So you have to, it's not just enough that you can process information because if I, for example, have fantastic eyesight, ear sight, you know, I'm aware of my surroundings, but I don't have any prior understanding of the game. I have no database of experience and trial and error within the sport. That's also useless. So I have to be able to derive meaning from that information and synthesize and analyze. So analyze is what does all this information mean and what are the implications for what I'm currently doing, the problem that I'm trying to solve. And then synthesis is what are my options right now? How can I respond to this problem? And I'm trying to use that database of information to select the most appropriate response to that motor problem. And then once I've done that, then I have to act. I have to execute it and be constantly running through that loop, tweaking and refining my responses to those problems because sport is constantly evolving, constantly changing. And if his or
hopefully jumps in here. Guys, go ahead while he's buffering here. Throw some questions into the comment section, and I'll make sure to get through these. We're going to go here in a second and do kind of a questions and answers as we go through. So add some below. Also, let me know what you think about this being on Instagram Live, you know, putting Iron Game Chalk Talk on Instagram Live as opposed to me shooting it and just adding it to iTunes. I'm still going to add them to iTunes. So those of you that listen to the podcast as you go, we'll definitely continue with that. But we want to make sure that we bring as many different ways. And I think this adds an element of interactivity that hasn't been happening. There he is. You there?
Yeah, I don't know what happened there.
Okay.
So when do I get off?
Just you know, when you're going through just the environment and how the body responds to the environment.
You have to be able to perceive your environment. You have to be able to derive meaning from it. You have to be able to analyze what that means and what's likely to happen next. You have to be able to synthesize your response to that situation based on previous experience. And then you have to be able to execute it. And the faster you can run through that loop, the higher the likelihood that you're going to win. Because if I'm still running through a loop that says, oh, Ron's cutting to my right-hand side, and you've already identified it, know that if you cut left, you're going to beat me, and you're executing it, I'm going to have to reset that loop and go, oh, no, he's cutting to my left.
Sure.
So the faster we're able to run through that loop, the faster we're and more effectively we're going to be able to solve sporting problems. So when we think about agility and we think about going back to the combine, 3-cone, 5-10-5, all of these largely non-reactive drills,
right,
we are not actually evaluating the full picture of agility. We're just asking guys to execute and make a choice, which is really left versus right, or just respond to, you know, a move of the ball. Whereas in the reality of sport is we're asking them to quickly perceive their environment, run through a whole host of different scenarios in their head, and then come up with a response to it. So to assume that we're accurately evaluating agility with those tests, I think is flawed. And then to assume that we are adequately training agility with things like bouncy balls, ladders, even general reactive drills like change direction on a whistle, it's useful because it gets you reacting to a stimulus, but it's not a relevant stimulus, and there's no processing of that information required.
Right.
So this is why, to quote James Smith, strength and conditioning is dead, because eventually you bleed so far over with your agility design, you end up becoming a sport coach.
Yeah.
Or vice versa. So I think ultimately we're all sport coaches. We just have different flavors that we specialize in, and we have to, again, learn how to collaborate with one another to come up with an optimal solution.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. I mean, agility by its very nature is react. I mean, if not, it's just change of direction, right? And it's closed loop skills. And so right now it doesn't have to be, especially with tools available to us like the Fusion Sport timing system and things along those lines where you could add a reactive component to it. Mm-hmm. You know, and not have to be in a million different places at once. It's silly, right? So I agree.
Yeah.
I agree with you 100% on that. And you know, just getting into, you know, just overall transfer, right? I mean, you know, does that really transfer? And is weightlifting, is that transferring? You know, your traditional weightlifting exercise, is that transferring to the, you know, to sport as well?
Well, I mean, I can tell you, just from my experience in Japan, like we ran the numbers on all of the stuff that everyone says is supposed to transfer to speed and power development, and there was like zero correlation. There was no correlation whatsoever between the squat and jumping and sprinting. And these were highly trained athletes in terms of training age.
Sure.
No correlation, even when we made it relative to body weight. So I think, I'm not saying it doesn't transfer. What I'm saying is you have to understand what transfers for your group, because we are taking research done on college-age males, recreationally weight-trained, and assuming that the same applies to highly trained athletes. Might not be the case. And here's the thing as well, is like, if you're familiar with Jake Jensen, who's been the translator for Bondarchuk for a while, I had a somewhat upsetting conversation with him this year, which is, in the Bondarchuk system, a specialized developmental exercise is an exercise where you can have a high degree of confidence, if not certainty, that an improvement in that exercise is going to result in an improvement on the field of play event. So if I throw an overweight or underweight hammer and I improve by, for example, 3 meters in that exercise, I can be almost 100% confident that I'm going to improve my competition throw. If we improve an athlete's 40 or their vert or their 5-10-5 or anything like that, can we have the same degree of confidence or certainty that we're going to see improved agility on the field of play? And the answer is not at all.
Right.
Because at the time of these guys, you know, maybe go from track and field to football, and there's no improvement. There's not necessarily the high level of performance. And that's because we completely negate the psycho-perceptual aspect of it, the decision-making. So at best, what we do is specialized preparatory. And again, if you want to have that degree of influence where you can say, yes, I am making an impact on the field of play, you must work with sport coaches to come up with drills which do contain those elements, and you can have a degree of confidence transfers to the field of play.
Yeah, I think obviously, and I'm glad you kind of you jumped in there and kind of even clarified that a little bit. I mean, do we believe that power clean and squat and snatch do they have benefits? Absolutely. You know, I think it's all on a spectrum, right? And it's I think what the problem with people is it lies when they lie in the extremes. You know, it's 100% of what I do because I believe wholeheartedly it's translating, or I don't believe in it at all and I'm not going to do it. You know, it's not, those are the polar extremes aren't the answer, but it's taking each situation, like you're saying, working with the sport coaches, because that to me, that's how I've always viewed myself. I've never viewed myself as just a strength and conditioning coach. I always viewed myself as a football coach, that my specialty was strength and conditioning, you know, and that's where I was at. Just like, instead of coaching quarterbacks, I was coaching in the weight room. And I think when we attack that way, we look for, you know, at the end of the day, what is going to translate to wins and losses. And, and so much of that is not even the weight room, much less what we do in the weight room. So I agree with that. I want to get to some of these questions. If you guys are listening, you know, throw some questions in below. Just short answers on some of these here, but let's go through and see what some people have here. I guess we'll start with Mike's and whether or not you're going to change your online branding from rugby strength coach to something more geared towards what you're doing.
I wouldn't be so bold as to brand myself the football strength coach. I'm still learning.
Well, no, but I think, I guess a better question would be, are you going to continue to keep your foot in the rugby space? Obviously, with what you got going on with Strength Coach Network, those types of things.
Yeah.
You're going to keep
those. Well, I mean, from the rugby side of things, I still work privately with a ton of rugby players. I still, work with clubs, work with individuals in rugby. So, I've not completely walked away from rugby. The Strength Coach Network stuff is actually a recognition that my venture was called the Rugby Strength Coach Community, and then I realized half of them work in soccer or the Irish sports, or they've never seen a rugby ball. So what I did do was cast the net a little bit wider to encompass strength coaching in general and all sports, and also I've expanded into the business side of things, because I think Seth Godin wrote that, let's say 100 years ago, poets used to make a lot of money. And there just came a time when, poetry, there's no money in it anymore, but that doesn't discourage people from being poets. You just have to accept that that's the reality of the field that you've entered into. Strength and conditioning, the days of you're going to make 100 grand a year with a degree and barely that's it.
Right.
Those days are gone. The competition is supply and demand. The competition amongst coaches has pushed the wages down. The security has gone down. So you must just accept the reality that if this is what you want to do, there is an inherent risk involved. and that you're going to get robustness and security from working for yourself or having secondary streams of income. So that's another stream that we've added to the community to try and help coaches prepare for that reality. So 100%. I'm trying to broaden my horizons a little bit, but also not forget the roots.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. That's something that I've preached quite a bit. Coach Dorian asked, what are your guys' thoughts on prioritizing KPIs for football players at the pro and amateur level? Of course, it depends on the individual athlete, but are there trends?
I think there is not enough of a trend. I think if you look at thinking slow, thinking fast, humans have a really bad habit of taking complex questions and replacing them in their head with simple questions and answering that instead. We've taken the very complex question of how do you improve performance and replaced it with how do you make somebody's squat or power clean go up. So I think we have to be really, really clear in our KPIs, outlining what it is that we want our guys to be excellent at, and then ensuring that those numbers continue to go up. Because if, for example, if I have a DB who's 40 goes down, but I put 100 pounds in his squat, I've probably failed him as a coach. So I think we have to be clear in what it is we're trying to do.
JD De Silva asks, given your experiences now, being in college athletics, do you believe that college football is open to change?
In the right circumstances, yes. Sorry, I'm just going to go downstairs because my battery is about to die, but I'll keep talking. So, yes, I do think it's open to change, but I think you have to have the right people with you in the organization. I've learned the hard way in certain environments that you can account for the shortcomings of people below you. 1 second, sorry.
This is like a weird moment.
You guys, while he's getting settled, if you got some questions, throw them down below. We're going to jump off the questions here in a second.
There we go. Battery, can you hear me?
Yep, perfect.
Okay, so again, quoting James Smith, and this is not to say that anyone I've worked with is incompetent, but he made the point that when you work in a team or an organization, you can only account for the shortcomings of people below you. So if you're a CEO, for example, or a general manager, you get to influence how everybody in that place works. Right. And you can hire and fire, and you can change the structure. If you're an intern, you can only change you. You're not going to tell your boss how to work. Or you can hope, but it's probably not going to happen. So I think when we talk about successful organizations and organizations which are open to change, it begins with the CEO or it begins with the boss. So I think there's no way that I would be as lucky as I am now to work in the environment that I do now if it wasn't for our athletic director, Samantha. And she was open-minded enough to bring Eric in, and Eric is not conventional. And he was open-minded enough to bring me in, and I've never run a football team. But it's all those pieces falling into place, and we're pretty lucky that we appear to have that going on here at William & Mary.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I couldn't agree more. It's called, John Maxwell has that, it's called the law of the lid. Whoever your leader is, whatever the level they're at, that's really the cap of what the program or the organization can be at, unless you bring in, people that can raise it beyond that, surround yourself with them. So I agree 100%. Last question from the group here. What's the biggest difference between strength and conditioning in England and America?
I'll have a positive and a negative. So the positive is the sheer enthusiasm and energy of Americans, and I think it's interesting. Like I've spoken to a lot of people about America since I arrived in America.
Sure.
And this guy made a point to me. He said, America is basically a country built on, screw you guys, I'm leaving. So it's just a country built on people that want to get after it and they want to win. And they're not ashamed of saying it. And everything they do is about win. And guys compete at the college level to get to the next level. And I absolutely love that energy. Now, the downside to that, I think, is the industrialization of strength conditioning within American colleges. We say we're all about elite performance and mastery and high performance stuff, but it's akin to being like a factory worker. Here's 20 teams. Good luck.
Yeah.
Anyone who has all those teams to train, you are the only way you're going to survive is with a cookie cutter approach.
Sure.
And I think that's the thing that I find most challenging about the collegiate environment in the States is that we almost pay lip service to high performance because we say we want it, but then we give practitioners a ridiculous number of teams, a ridiculous number of hours, and I think the two sometimes are just not compatible with one another. So those are the major differences, but unquestionably, I love being here. I love being in that environment and the energy, and I'm excited for what it brings.
Absolutely. Well, man, we end the show with some resources here. Give us the best piece of coaching advice you ever received.
Experience is what you got when you didn't get what you wanted.
All right, I like it. Give us a book, app, and website recommendation.
Book, I'd say, I'm going to give him a plug here. Governing Dynamics of Coaching by James Smith. Probably hands down.
So the problem with strength and conditioning is that most of these weight rooms are in the basement level, and it makes it pretty tough to do these live streams, but hopefully he jumps back on here in a second. For the rest of you guys, any of these questions that we didn't get to, I'm sure he'll jump back in and be able to answer them, or you can reach out to him directly and just follow him on the Instagram and whatnot. There we go. Let's add him back in. Gonna wrap up here just in a few seconds, guys. All right, hopefully he's jumping back in. Harry,
how's it going?
There he is. All right, good. All right, book, you got any dynamics of coaching, you said? Can you hear me?
Yep, so a book, an app, and a website.
Yeah.
App. Let me think. You can't go wrong with like a good interval app. Maybe Dartfish. Like, I think it's not even an app, but just the ability to record athletes and show what they did, because you have to get to that conscious incompetence before you can get to conscious competence.
Exactly.
Or hopefully unconscious competence. And you know, so many athletes are in that state of unconscious incompetence, and video can be a powerful tool in helping them to spot those flaws and self-correct as well, and get them invested in the process.
Great.
And then website. I'm not going to be shameless and plug my own website, strengthcoachnetwork.com. I will say, what's a good website? I just like the New York Times at the moment.
There you go.
Being aware of the...
I don't know if you want to, right now, if you read the New York Times, it's not going to give you, it's not going to excite you too much, I don't think, but.
There it is.
Hey, what's up, man?
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt the podcast.
Say hi to the Instagram world.
Hey, this guy's the best.
Nice to see you, buddy.
Absolutely best. Appreciate you, Coach
you
Mac.
Too, brother. Well, you know. That's good spot at the end, but you know, man, I just, you know, I mean, super smart guy. I really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing with everybody. I think some of these guys, you know, there's some other questions in here you might be able to jump back in and answer, but I'm so impressed by people that challenge themselves to go outside of their, you know, outside of their comfort zone. And there's no better example of that than somebody that's willing to travel the world, learn from different cultures, learn from different people, different coaches, seek out extremely smart people and keep upskilling themselves to where, you know, you become that leader in the world. and that's what you've done, man. So appreciate you coming on the show and sharing, and really enjoy the work that you're doing.
My pleasure, mate. Thank you so much for having me on.
Absolutely, man. Thanks, guys. Appreciate you guys joining us. Take care. Have a great day, buddy. Yeah.
That's it for this episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk. Thanks to this week's guest, as well as our sponsors, for bringing this episode to you for free. Make sure to check out ronmckeefrey.com, where you can join our mailing list, find the show notes, including all the links and resources mentioned, and information about Coach McKeefrey's other products. While you are there, please join Coach McKeefrey in the comments section thanking our guest for sharing. If you haven't subscribed to Iron Game Chalk Talk on YouTube or iTunes yet, make sure to do so. Comments, ratings, and reviews are always welcome. Coach McKeefrey can be found on Twitter at @rmckeefrey, on Facebook and YouTube at @ron.mckeefrey. That's it for this week. Be sure to check back next week for another great episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk.